of Islam and Christianity among the sub-Saharan African populace. In 1900, about 80% of African people would have identified themselves as polytheist. By the early 21st century, this percentage was down to 20%, with about 40% of the people Muslim, about 40% Christian, roughly evenly divided between Protestant and Catholic. So this is a big cultural story, a story of missionary activity on the part of Christians and Muslims alike, a story of individual African people and groups seeking new kinds of religious affiliations that would attach them for the first time to one of the great world religions. A really important, vibrant story of cultural change, but very different from the story that would emphasize the rise of Marxism, nationalism, and liberal humanitarianism. Latin America also provides a somewhat different story. Here too, of course, nationalism had some roots. Marxism would gain ground in certain cases, and without question, increasing interest in consumerism, science, and cosmopolitan outlook would spread, particularly among middle-class urbanites. But much of the cultural story of Latin America in the past half century has been the increasing interest, particularly in places like Brazil and Guatemala, in the increasing interest in Protestant fundamentalism, massive movement of evangelical missionary activity into parts of Latin America with huge successes to register, and also, again, in places like Brazil, the growing importance of new religious amalgams, which combined elements of Christianity with elements of Native American and African tradition, and sometimes some European scientific beliefs as well. Change in the religious scene, not changes away from the religious scene, marked this regional situation. A third regional case, although more strictly recent one, obviously involves the cultural aftermath of the fall of Marxism in Eastern Europe and the effective reduction of Marxist cultural enthusiasm even in China. In the wake of the fall of Marxism, some people were once again open to new religious influences. There were revivals of Orthodox Christianity in Russia, interesting new penetrations here also of Protestant evangelical missionary activity, particularly stemming from the United States, although closely watched by and sometimes hampered by Russian authorities and Orthodox priests. The rise of the Falun Gong in China, a vaguely Buddhist-derived religious movement, extremely unpopular with the communist authorities, is another interesting specific religious story applying to a particular region. So, point one, the pattern that we started with, the challenge to traditional belief systems by new cultural allegiances, remains a valid one. It's part of the process of world history in the contemporary period. But we need separate regional stories as well that are sometimes quite different from, or at least provide significant modifications to, the basic narrative. The second issue, very familiar since the late 1970s, the second issue can have more global dimensions, although it also has regional components. The second issue involves the revival of religious enthusiasms and the rise of what some authorities call religious fundamentalism, not only in Islam, where the phenomenon has been most clearly noted, but also in Western, particularly United States Christianity, in Hinduism, and even in elements of Judaism and Buddhism as well. Religious fundamentalism, and it's a complicated, challenging, and doubtless oversimple term that some authorities don't like to use at all. Religious fundamentalism, obviously, urges, first of all, the transcendent importance of religious commitments and a religious cultural framework as against the new forces of nationalism, Marxism, or liberal humanitarianism. Religious fundamentalists don't like any of these three options, although they may obviously flirt with one or two of them to some degree. Religious fundamentalists also urge that there is an established traditional body of religious truth to which adherents of their religion should return, often involving stricter moral codes than seem to be predominant in contemporary society, rearrangements of gender relationships to insist on real or imagined traditional qualities. They insist then that there is a, and this is why the fundamentalist term is used, they insist that there is a core set of beliefs back in the original religion from which religious people themselves have strayed. So religious people need to return to their foundations, and religion needs to be reemphasized as against its new cultural competitors. Religious fundamentalism, however, and this again applies to all the fundamentalisms, not just Islamic, religious fundamentalism also, of course, typically involves innovation. Religious fundamentalists, among other things, are adept at using modern technology. They are skilled at uses of the internet and other technological devices to spread their message and win or reattach adherents. Many religions under the spur of fundamentalism also become more intolerant than they had been traditionally. Hindu fundamentalists, for example, are noticeably edgier, sometimes even outright aggressive, with regard to India's Muslim minority than Hindus often were in more traditional times. Islamic fundamentalists typically scorn the basically tolerant traditions of their religion when it comes to other faiths, when it certainly comes to one of the modern belief systems, and even sometimes increase the intolerance of minority or dissident groups within Islam itself. Christian fundamentalists, so Christianity traditionally is less marked as a tolerant religion, Christian fundamentalists are often also noteworthy for their intolerance of other cultural and political alternatives. Many fundamentalists, although this is not necessarily new in the religion, also insist increasingly on the importance of gaining state support for their religious goals and for their religious codes. So fundamentalism, the rise of fundamentalism, indicates, obviously, a definite and vigorous reaction to the new secular cultural alternatives. Involves also a reaction to the somewhat more latitudinarian tolerant approaches within the religion itself and suggests significant innovation, particularly when it comes to political policy and the uses of technology. Why has fundamentalism gained ground? A huge topic, I admit, but it seems to me some outlines are relevant. First of all, fundamentalism has gained ground in part in specific reaction to the cosmopolitan features of new cultural systems, particularly, of course, consumerism, but sometimes Marxism as well. It's a reassertion of real or imagined traditional identity as against outside influences that are seen as harmful as well as unfamiliar. Religious revivals also reflect the fact that many of the new cultural systems, perhaps all of them, fail to provide many people with real spiritual satisfaction. We've noted already, they're secular, they can be regarded as superficial, they do not probe the mysteries of life and death, they do not encourage attention to forces beyond the secular realm to the nature of divinity, they do not encourage exploration of the afterlife for purely spiritual reasons. Many people may find existing cultural alternatives as established by modern missionaries, modern advocates, may find these systems just simply wanting. And obviously, particularly, though it's important not to be oversimplistic here, religious fundamentalism has frequently appealed to social groups, particularly urbanites, particularly poorer urbanites, who find themselves left out of the benefits, real or imagined, of the modern world. People who are having trouble getting jobs, people who are having trouble identifying any improvements in their standard of living. It's difficult, after all, particularly to sustain a commitment to consumerism if your real consumerist opportunities are in fact extremely restricted. So for a variety of reasons, particularly for certain groups, I think also for certain regions, religious alternatives seem to be increasingly important toward the end of the 20th, early 21st century because of failures and unevenness in the new belief systems themselves. And finally, of course, the cultural collapse of Marxism, the fact that one of the belief systems is no longer vigorous enough to be particularly attractive, can factor into this religious revival as well. The results are twofold. First, obviously, a certain degree of regional division. A few regions, although perhaps touched a little bit by religious revivals, a few regions seem largely content to be pretty secular. Japan has not significantly revisited its conversion to a combination of nationalism, but above all, consumerism and commitment to science. Western Europe remains largely a non-religious society. So a few regions really seem to have been part of a process of cultural change that has at least temporarily reached a fairly uniform conclusion. Of course, there are religious minorities. Of course, there are vestiges of religious belief, but this is no longer the dominant framework. Most parts of the world, however, need to be seen in terms of significant internal divisions, of conflict among groups within the region. Of course, there are regions in which religion looms larger than average. The United States is an unusually religious society. Much of the Middle East is unusually religious. And interestingly, although people worry about the conflict between the United States and the Middle East, this is actually a quality they share and could be the basis for some constructive dialogue. The key point, however, is not to see most of the regions of the world in totally straightforward terms. That is, they've either converted to one of the new belief packages, or they're simply religious. The conflict between secular loyalties and leadership and religious enthusiasms in the Middle East, in the United States, in Latin America, to some degree in Africa, although religion may be more purely dominant here, although not a single religion. These conflicts are actually, it seems to me, the key point, which leads then to the two final points. First of all, we can talk and have talked about the importance of cultural change, about the importance of cultural challenge as helping to shape the contemporary period of world history, but we sure don't know the end of the story. Is the revival of religion merely a last gasp, as secular loyalties will ultimately end up predominating? Or is it, as some people would argue, not necessarily themselves particularly religious? Is it the wave of the future? And it will be consumerism, Marxism, nationalism that will end up being scrap heaps in the refuse bin of history. We just don't know the end of the story. And the second conclusion, obviously, involves insisting on the real complexity that cultural divisions within regions, as well as among them, add to the story of global politics. We talked last time about the potential for the spread of democracy in additional regions such as the Middle East. Well, obviously, one of the question marks about democracy in the Middle East involves the questions about cultural division. Middle Eastern democracy might produce new majorities for the Islamic faith and for Islamic fundamentalism. The extent to which this cultural option is seen as operating in tension with frequently desired political goals adds obviously a huge complexity to policy determinations as well as calculations for world history to come.
Lecture 35, Gender in Contemporary World History.
Changes in gender relations and debates and questions about gender relations constitute one of the really important themes in the contemporary period of world history. They also allow us to measure this period against previous developments, and as we will discuss particularly at the end of this session, they raise some really interesting analytical issues for any contemporary person to think about. So It's not in the interest of political correctness, making sure that we pay due attention to women, but because these issues are really an important aspect of contemporary world history and touch so many other aspects of contemporary world history, that we introduce this segment at this point. Again, first a backdrop, because we haven't specifically dealt with gender issues for a while. Early in our discussions, we established that patriarchal gender relations became characteristic of agricultural economies, and we talked about the reason for this. We talked about the extent to which all the great classical civilizations enshrined patriarchal relationships in codes of law and codes of conduct, although each society had its own particular take on exactly how to interpret patriarchy. We noted for the post-classical period that two, frankly, contradictory trends began to emerge that constituted the next reshaping of gender relationships. In the first instance, the spread of world religions established the new importance of spiritual equality between men and women and began to attack certain traditional practices like female infanticide. But at the same time, sometimes partly perhaps because religions allowed women new cultural outlets, at the same time, some key practical trends set in that could worsen women's conditions, the most notorious being the beginning of the practice of foot binding in parts of China, particularly initially among the urban upper classes. The early modern period and even the long 19th century did not introduce systematic global changes in gender relations. There were important specific social and regional stories. The spread of Western colonialism often brought Western standards to hunting and gathering or agricultural peoples, and Westerners, sometimes with the best of intentions, began to insist on domestic roles for women, public roles for men, for example, as against Native American practices that would lead to de facto deterioration of women's conditions. The spread of world economic relationships, for example, the development of transatlantic slavery, had clear implications for gender relations, including in Africa, where more men were taken than women. The Industrial Revolution, for those societies directly involved, had gender implications as well. But nothing before 1914 or so, it's not a magic date for gender, but nevertheless, nothing systematically challenged the basic patriarchal frameworks that had been established in agricultural economies and often deepened in the post-classical period. The contemporary period of world history ushers in some developments that, it seems to me, clearly erode traditional patriarchy, even though they don't necessarily establish real equality yet. And broadly speaking, I think that the contemporary period of world history will be regarded as one in which many traditional gender assumptions were rethought, many traditional relationships reconstituted, a significant period of gender change that then, and a period in which gender change played a significant role in political, cultural, and economic discussions as well. There were a number of factors pushing for change. Most of the great revolutions of the 20th century, in interesting contrast to the Atlantic revolutions, that usually didn't have a lot of gender impact in any real sense. Most of the 20th century revolutions heralded their implications for gender relations, conservative implications in the case of the Iranian Revolution, but at least in principle liberating consequences in the Marxist revolutions and in Mexico. Women found in the revolutionary regimes, again with the exception of Iran, women found new opportunities for certain kinds of public roles. They found themselves newly praised in art. Principles of legal equality were established. Actual domestic situations might not change as much as the rhetoric suggested. Women might continue to be expected to perform largely domestic functions or to combine these with demanding work roles. So Marxism particularly didn't in fact usher in heaven on earth for women, but the rhetorical change and to some extent the changes in real opportunities were significant nevertheless. Nationalist movements frequently used women actively These were ways in which the population could be further mobilized. These were people who could help stimulate and exemplify resistance to colonial oppression. It often occurred that once the nationalist movement succeeded, women were shunted aside. This was a characteristic pattern, for example, in Africa. But even that process, by creating frustration and galvanizing women to voice their concern that what had been promised was not being delivered, even that process could help accelerate change. Larger developments also enter in. Obviously, world economic relationships could have an impact on gender, and we'll touch on this more clearly a bit later on. Changes in production processes could provide new opportunities for women, for example, in certain kinds of factories, but they could also produce new competition for women's work. There was no single set of impacts here, but the framework obviously needs to be attended to. It's also true, obviously, that larger processes, such as urbanization, such as the reduction of infant mortality, larger processes would also have an impact on women in many instances. One of the reasons that women in most societies, by at least the later 20th century, earlier in some cases, began to have fewer children than was traditionally the case, involves simply the working out of an understanding of what urban conditions and modern public health conditions implied for traditional levels of birth rates. Equally important, and increasingly important from the 1950s onward, were the operations of international agencies, both governmental and non-governmental. By the late 19th century, in fact, a number of international feminist movements had formed. They were, in fact, almost entirely Western, but they claimed international audience, and they worked hard to gather at least a few representatives from places like China, Iran, etc. These movements pressed a women's rights agenda on governments around the world and on other international agencies that would press for greater legal equality, in some cases for rights of political expression, etc. By the 1920s and 30s, women's agencies became fairly adept at pressuring the League of Nations to issue statements, at least, urging gender equality. Not a lot happened, but the fact that an international agency, a representative of the international community, could be pushed to this kind of declaration in principle was itself revealing. The United Nations would turn out to be even more sympathetic than the League to women's rights statements in principle. United Nations Charter, statements of rights, conventionally included gender issues, and while these might ring hollow, they nevertheless provided a framework of legitimacy for pressure in individual societies toward changing gender laws and gender relationships more widely. Then in 1965, the United Nations began a pattern of sponsoring Years of the Woman every decade, or even a Decade of the Woman. And these measures, punctuated by large international conferences such as the one held in Mexico City in 1965 or the one held in Beijing in 1995. These conferences would spawn attendance by women's groups and women's representatives literally from all over the world. And in their wake, not only would the conferences themselves issue ringing pronouncements about the importance of equality, about the importance of equal pay, etc., pronouncements in themselves interesting, but the conferences would spawn local NGOs, local non-government organizations that would work on women's rights issues, that would report on these issues to larger groups like Amnesty International. By the 1970s and 80s, a real international network was being established whereby wrongs against women could be fairly readily publicized and international redress sought. A variety of factors pushed for change. During the 20th and early 21st centuries, there were certain clear directions to change as well, largely in line with at least a watered-down version of these formal agendas. In the first place, beginning a little before the World War in Scandinavia and after the World War in various other societies, the notion of allowing women the right to vote, sometimes first in local elections, then nationally, gained growing currency. After World War I, voting rights for women were established in the United States, in the Soviet Union, in Germany, in Turkey, interestingly, and often gradually then in other European countries, though full European conversion to women's suffrage was not completed until after World War II, indeed well after, in the interesting single case of Switzerland. Women, normally, where voting was permitted at all, by the second half of the 20th century, women normally voted. Other legal rights really were attached to this basic conversion in the suffrage systems. Legal rights that established increasing parity with regard to access to divorce. Legal rights establishing clearer title to property as against male or familial control. These activities were important areas of gains for the women's rights agenda. Third area, along with voting rights and legal rights, involved education. Without any question, although in some regions like Africa and the Middle East, women's education at the primary level continued to lag behind that of men, women gained ground on men during the 20th and to date the 21st centuries. They gained ground partly because they started from a lower base. So the increase in literacy rates for women was more rapid than that for men because women had more ground to make up. By the early 21st century, in an impressive variety of societies, women actually began to gain majority ascendancy even in the ranks of students in higher education. In Iran, in the United Arab Emirates, in the United States, in various other places by the early 21st century, women constituted about 55% or more of the university population. A really tremendous change, and probably a promise also for further change in the future, because as women's educational parity gained ground with that of men, it surely would lead subsequently to other demands for greater job opportunities, greater political voice, etc. Voting rights and legal rights and educational change also propelled increasing female representation directly in elected legislatures. Obviously, there were interesting regional variations here. Intriguingly, despite its vociferous feminist movement, the United States actually lagged in this area, not only not generating until sometime in the 21st century an actual female president, but lagging also in the percentage of women elected to Congress and even to state legislatures. But women did gain in the United States. They gained political leadership roles in various parts of Europe periodically. In South Asia, while not in leadership roles in China, they certainly held important ministerial positions. The same applied to Russia, perhaps with a slight lag. Political gains then went beyond constitutional and legal rights. Women also gained, although this is a more contested terrain as to its significance, women also gained in consumerism. While men frequently accused women of being voracious consumers as a means of gender criticism, the fact was that both men and women participated in consumerism and both found meaning in it. I'm not arguing here that women necessarily found more meaning than men did, but because this was an area in which they had some clear opportunities for self-expression in buying things, in identifying goods that were desirable, etc., consumerism also can be seen as a terrain in which they gained a new measure of equality, or at least a new kind of outlet for expression. And as a subset of consumerism, the rise of women in sports, particularly international sports and some key sports in the later 20th century, was an interesting development as well. These various changes, to one degree or another, applied literally to almost every region of the world. Different degrees, of course, different specific chronologies. But they add up, I would suggest, to what I think we have to admit is probably the end of literal patriarchal systems. That is, patriarchal systems, while they may be compatible with informal voice for women, with individual women achieving great things, patriarchal systems are not compatible with systematic legal equality or with equality of voting rights. Now, we don't have to use this statement to argue that therefore everything's just fine. Feminists still enjoy using the term patriarchy as a means of slamming ongoing inequalities, and more power to them. But I believe from an historical standpoint, we have to see developments in the 20th century as suggesting the beginning of the end of the kind of patriarchal systems that had predominated through the long agricultural period of world history.